This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It was one of the most visceral outrages of the crisis at the border. Two children who died in U.S. custody. For critics of the Trump administration, they became symbols of the injustice wrought by the president's policies and by his demands for a wall. For the president's supporters, they were a tragedy that highlighted the need for tougher border security to prevent families from subjecting their children to such risks. But history adds another layer to this. Both of those children were from a region of Guatemala that was hit hard by that country's civil war. And what nation helped spark that civil war by unseating Guatemala's president? The United States. Central America's problems are not entirely of America's making, but the U.S. has been a major factor in the conditions there which drive people to our southern border. What have we done? And what can we do now? Joining us from NPR in New York is Brian Winter, the editor-in-chief for America's Quarterly and a Latin America political analyst. Brian, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Joshua. I'm happy to be here.
Also at NPR in New York is Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU and the author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall. Professor Grandin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And at Arizona Public Media, Elizabeth Oglesby is a professor of Latin American Studies at Arizona State University. Professor Oglesby, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about the crisis at the border, particularly America's role in the politics and economy of Central America. We'd especially love to hear from you if this has affected you personally. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Grandin, let's start with the border as it exists right now. Customs and Border Patrol is doing its best to keep an eye on the border. In some places, it feels very militarized with various kinds of walls and fences and barriers. How long has it been this way? Is it a fairly new incarnation of the border, or has it been this way for some time?
No, it's a fairly new incarnation of the border. 100 years ago, the border was practically wide open and non-existent. There was seasonal migration back and forth to factories, to farms, to houses, and it wasn't around the time till about World War One that the border began to be policed and militarized. The Border Patrol was created in 1924. It was created as part of the Immigration Reform Act that was in many ways a kind of nativist triumph, that it finally set quotas on immigrants from Southern Europe, from Central Europe, from Eastern Europe, raised quotas for white Protestants from Western Europe. But the thing that law did was that it didn't put quotas on the Western Hemisphere. Mexico could still send as many migrants as the labor market would absorb into the United States. But at the same time, it created a border patrol that invested an enormous amount of power in local on-the-spot agents to decide who came in and came out legally and illegally through ports of entry and whatnot. But the real militarization happened around the 1990s with Bill Clinton. It was Bill Clinton forward through Clinton, through George W. Bush, and through Barack Obama that the border became this very militarized zone. And the point was, and I'll just wrap up this little segment here, is that it began to close down relatively safe urban border crossings and forcing migrants into the desert. And it was explicitly part of the policy. They used the harsh geography of the desert as a deterrent. Mm-hmm. But the effect that had was that it raised the cost. It basically made going back and forth impossible. Once migrants got here, they stayed here.
Brian Winter,
Once that happened, the migrant population, undocumented resident population, exploded.
With regard to that population, Brian Winter, where are most of these asylum seekers coming from in Central America?
Well, as opposed to, say, 15 years ago when the overwhelming majority, or at least a lot of these people, were coming from Mexico, today most of the migration comes from three main countries in what's called the Northern Triangle region of Central America, and that is El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. The net migration from Mexico is actually negative now. There's more people going back to Mexico than there are Mexicans coming into the United States. And these three countries that I named and Central America. I mean, these are troubled places. These are places with more than half of their population getting by on less than $2 a day, with economies that grow but not fast enough to create jobs or reduce inequality, which is very high. And they also have governments that, in many cases, are at the bottom of global or near the bottom of global corruption rankings. And just really aren't able to do enough for their populations.
Professor Oglesby, how much does U.S. policy factor into the plight of folks living in this Northern Triangle in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras? I mean, is there an example that you might point to where we can see a direct connection between U.S. policy and the current state of affairs, or is it more complicated than that?
What people need to understand is that Central Americans have been struggling for decades to build more equitable and democratic societies and to be able to stay on their lands and in their communities. The United States, over the past half century, put itself time and time again on the wrong side of those struggles, and now we are seeing the consequences. Specific examples would include Guatemala, where the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency in 1954 orchestrated a coup that overthrew the reformist government of Jacobo Arbenz, which was trying to implement agrarian reform that would have benefited communities all across rural Guatemala. That was overturned, and that was really the start of decades of civil conflict in Guatemala that accelerated into a genocide in the early 1980s, at which time the U.S. was also supporting tacitly the military government of Guatemala during the genocide. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced in the early 1980s from Guatemala and also from El Salvador. That's really the genesis of the great migration to the United States that we see from Central America.
And just to be clear, Professor Oglesby, why did the U.S. decide to intervene and support that militaristic government?
The United States, again, time and time again, has come down on the side of the status quo in Central America. So there were massive social movements in Central America in the 1970s and early 1980s to try to change the conditions in the country, to allow people to live better lives, to have a better future. But those movements came up against the limits of what a very intolerant system was willing to tolerate in Central America. So they challenged exclusionary political and economic systems and extractive economic systems that the U.S., quite frankly, was benefiting from during the Cold War.
We are speaking to Professor Elizabeth Oglesby, who teaches Latin American Studies at Arizona State University, Brian Winter, Editor-in-Chief at America's Quarterly and the Vice President of the Americas Society, Council of the Americas, and Professor Greg Grandin, who teaches History at NYU. He is the author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall. We're starting to get in some of your questions, great questions about the relationship between the U.S. and Central American countries. We also welcome your stories of how these relationships have affected you directly. Perhaps you or your family members migrated from Central America into the U.S., and you have personal accounts of how U.S. policy affected your family's decision to come here. We welcome you sharing what you know about this situation, 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. Brian, can you paint us a picture of what life is like in some of these Central American countries now? We've heard about some of the problems. What about things like access to health care, schools, personal safety, government accountability, the economy? Are there any bright spots in this Northern Triangle, or are things kind of tough all over?
I mean, there are some bright spots. The economies, you know, they are growing about 4% a year these last couple of years, which, you know, sounds good. We love 4% growth in the United States, but like I said earlier, it's just not enough to create enough jobs. for people and better jobs and jobs that can reduce this inequality that has long been the crux the cross that this region, people in the region have had to bear. There was an interesting poll done by a Honduran think tank in 2018 where they asked people why they were leaving. They asked people who had had a family member emigrate, usually to the United States in the last 4 years, why they had left. And 83% said it was economic insecurity. Compared with 11% who said it was violence. And, you know, look, I mean, the violence in these countries is awful as well. I mean, the homicide rate in El Salvador and Honduras has been well above 50 per 100,000 people for years now. For way of comparison, in the U.S., that number is 5. So the murder rate in these countries has been 10 times as high. There's been some progress in Guatemala lately, which has cut its homicide rate. But, you know, these are places where drug gangs run rampant. And look, I mean, to the point about U.S. involvement in the region over the years and how that's been negative, there's no question that the U.S. has played a negative role, especially during the Cold War. It's also true that perhaps the greatest damage that Americans do to Central America these days is not through our government, but through our demand for drugs, for illegal drugs, which are driving so much of the violence in that part of the world.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. We have a question about the impact of the drug trade. John tweeted, "If Americans and Europeans stopped using illegal drugs, would that help alleviate the violence in Latin America?" Interesting question. We'll put that to our guests when we continue our conversation. We're speaking to NYU Professor Greg Grandin, Arizona State Professor Elizabeth Oglesby, and Brian Winter, the editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. We'll add some more voices to the conversation later on, and we'd definitely love to hear from you, your experiences in Central America, and what that reflects back to you about what's happening at the border right now. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are struggling with violence, economic hardship, and corruption. These conditions contribute to migrants making their way toward the U.S. southern border. We're discussing it this hour with Professor Greg Grandin of NYU, Professor Elizabeth Oglesby of Arizona State, and Brian Winter, the editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. We'd love to hear from you, your questions about the U.S. involvement in Central America, or what might be done to make the region more stable, or your experiences in Central America, either as a visitor or as a descendant of someone who is Honduran, Salvadoran, or Nicaraguan, or if you are from those countries yourself and migrated here to the U.S., we'd love it if you'd comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Before we keep going, Professor Oglesby, I wonder if you could respond to John's question about drugs. Brian mentioned the drug trade. John tweeted, "If Americans and Europeans stopped using illegal drugs, would that help alleviate the violence in Latin America?" Professor?
Yes, certainly that's a part of it. But the broader, the underlying issue is one of impunity, an impunity that's a legacy of the counterinsurgency wars in Central America during the Cold War. So the drug trade is part of that, but there are other parts as well. For example, U.S., Canadian, European foreign investment in Guatemala in extractive sectors like mining, hydroelectric dam projects, which are displacing a lot of communities, especially in Guatemala and Honduras. So the drug trade is part of the problem, but the underlying issue is one of impunity. That relates to what is going on in Guatemala right now, this week, which analysts in Guatemala are calling a slow-motion coup, where the president of Guatemala, Jimmy Morales, who was under investigation by Guatemala's Anti-Impunity Commission, has just expelled that commission from Guatemala in defiance of a court order. So Guatemala's in a constitutional crisis right now. In its effort to address those underlying issues of impunity,
I do want to talk more about what's going on in Guatemala as we continue our conversation, but let me get to a few more listener comments. Amanda emailed, I visited Roatan, Honduras a few years ago and was told by a local that the U.S., and in particular, former Secretary of State Clinton, had a direct hand in a military coup that overthrew a popular democratically elected president. Today, Honduras is a broken nation. Why? Why do we keep interfering in other countries? This topic has come up with several of you, including with this listener, Kay, who's from Washington State. Here's what Kay left in our inbox.
The thing that doesn't seem to be getting mentioned much is the U.S. Involvement in the politics of all those countries for quite a good many years, but we only have to look as far back as Honduras when the Democratic elected president who wanted to do things for the people and didn't want big business to just get big profits and leave, was done in by a coup, and our then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, recognized the new leader the very next day.
Kay, thanks very much for calling in. Professor Grandin, I wonder if you would respond to Kay and Amanda with regards to Secretary Clinton and Honduras.
Well, they're great questions and great points. And yes, the U.S. has been involved in Central America. I mean, in two ways. The specific incidents, the 1954 coup in Guatemala, the 2009 coup in Honduras, which is what's referred to, the Obama administration, there's debate about how directly involved it was in the actual coup, which overthrew a democratically elected reformer that was siding with social movements along the lines that Professor Oglesby talked about, classic kind of siding with the status quo. The Obama administration eventually recognized and legitimated that coup, and a lot of people have traced back the current disaster and catastrophe that's particularly in rural areas hard hit by the fast expansion of African palm for biofuel production in the Aguan Valley or in urban cities like San Pedro and Tegucigalpa. These are really some of the regions with the highest murder rate in the world, and that's driving a lot of the migration. So there's the specific events, and then there's the larger policies that the U.S. promotes that contribute to the out-migration. One is economic. What's often called development aid supports the infrastructure for further extraction, biofuel production, African palm, the fast spread of African palm in the Poloche Valley, where the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl, Jacqueline Kyle was from, is really devastated by African palm. A lot of the migrants from Honduras come from Aguan Valley, same thing, skyrocketing violence. There's the drug war. We talked about the drug trade, but there's also the drug war. A lot of the catastrophe that's happening in Central America could be traced back to Bill Clinton's Plan Colombia.
Actually, Professor Grandin, let me stop you there.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of moving parts here, and
yeah.
this is very complex. I just want to make sure we go
complex.
A little bit at a time. Would you
sure.
finish just explaining about African palm? What is that piece of this?
So
explain
African
that.
Palm is grown to produce biofuel. It's not native, obviously, to Central America. So a lot of peasant communities that grew corn or grew beans either for subsistence or for their own regional local markets are just being wiped out as large plantations move in. A lot of it is financed by U.S. development aid or multinational banks, developmental banks. And they move into regions that had been able to support some local economies, regional economies, markets, corn and beans, and just kind of spread through and displace these communities. And there's a lot of and that creates two things. One, there's fight back among the peasants who don't want to lose their land to plantations, either because of market forces or because landowners are using violence and coercion to get them to turn over title or to evict them.
Right.
Or they just have no more work. They corn is so cheap because they can't compete with U.S. agro industry because of these free trade treaties, or there's just not the markets have been completely distorted and destroyed as a result of this spread of a kind of plantation economy.
Okay, so hold right there. Let me
sure.
come back to Brian Winter on that point in particular. Do we have a clear sense in terms of the number of migrants we see coming, or trying at least to come into the U.S. along the southern border, of how much these particular effects have affected certain migrants? In other words, is there a way for us to know, Brian, you know, this many people from this country are attempting to cross into the southern border because of the influence of African palm on farmers and farm workers? Is there a way to know that?
I think there's a way to know it, you know, specifically by talking to people, and a lot of the reportage that I've seen and read from the border, you know, a lot of these people come from rural areas. There's no question. And in a country like Honduras, where you've got nearly two-thirds of the labor force either unemployed or underemployed, it's clear that there's something wrong with government policy in these places. But, you know, drawing generalizations about why they're coming, I think the best we can do is saying that it's because, you know, again, polling shows this. It is really economically driven. And in that sense, you know, what's happening there is new, and there are some factors that are unique to Central America. And then this is also a tale that is as old as time, and certainly as old as the United States itself, which is its people seeking opportunity in a richer, safer country, which is the U.S. I mean, that's what this country was made from.
Professor, sorry, Brian, finish your thought.
No, that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, Professor Oglesby, let me talk Guatemala for just a moment. As we mentioned, it's one of the countries very hard hit by U.S. foreign policy in Central America. We mentioned those two children who died last month in U.S. federal custody. One of them, Professor Grandin mentioned, Jacqueline Calmaquin, the other, Felipe Gomez Alonso, who both died after seeking asylum at the border with their families. We mentioned the U.S. and Guatemala and what happened in 1954. Professor Oglesby, what was the immediate consequence of that? Was it clear that the current state of affairs would shape up, or did it kind of take a while for things to get to the point where they are now?
Do you mean what was the consequence of the 54 coup?
Yeah, in terms of what has driven people out of Guatemala towards the U.S.
So the coup was a watershed in Guatemala. It really started a civil war that lasted until 1996, which had various intense moments, especially in the early 1980s, where the Guatemalan military committed genocide through a scorched earth campaign, nearly 700 massacres, displacing 1.5 million people, mostly in the rural areas of Guatemala. So that is the first great wave of Guatemalan migration to the United States. When the peace accords were signed in the 1990s, some people who had taken refuge in Mexico went back to Guatemala, but they found that they could not survive in the society that the war had created. And so international migration became a form of reparation, really, for those people. And that was supported by Guatemalan elites. They were only too happy to see people immigrated. Even the World Bank in the 1990s began to see international migration as a kind of development policy. Of course, then, after the 1990s, as Professor Grandin described, the border became more militarized. And so that seeking opportunity, or that form of international migration as reparation for the war, became much more difficult and dangerous for people. But the roots of the migration that we're seeing today are definitely in Guatemala, are definitely in that history of civil war and the history of displacement. And we're in many ways, we're seeing that replicated today. Perhaps not at the scale of the genocide of the early 1980s, but just in the last year, 30 environmental activists have been assassinated in Guatemala. And these are community leaders who are trying to protect their communities from extractive industries like mining or large-scale dams or the extension of African palm and sugarcane plantations for biofuel. These are the people who are trying to struggle for a different way of life so that people can stay in Guatemala.
Right.
but they're coming up against the limits of what the system is willing to tolerate, and there's a violent backlash. And so that's why I return to the problem of impunity, because as long as the states in Central America are captured by violent criminal networks, and as long as there is a life or death risk for community organizers who are trying to find a different way of life, then there can be no solution to this migration issue.
That might dovetail into a voicemail we got from Keith, who called us from Arlington, Virginia, not far from here. Here's what he left in our inbox.
I worked 40 years in Central America, 15 years with an official U.S. passport, and I saw that the U.S. bears some responsibility for problems in the region. For example, the U.S. negotiated a free trade agreement, which opened up markets, undermined the Central American small farm sector, and benefited our farmers and agribusinesses. It directly led to out-migration to cities and ultimately the U.S. and the further weakening of governance, police, and the courts.
Keith, thanks very much for calling in and sharing your experience with us. Brian, I wonder if you might respond to another question from a listener. They write, why is this, I think meaning the caravans of people coming from Central America, why is this happening now? I may be mistaken, but I don't recall caravans of people trying to enter our country before, so why now? Brian?
That's a good question. I think the caravan is kind of a sui generis thing. It's a phenomenon of its own because the flow of people has not substantially increased. We've had, you know, basically a flow over the southern border that really picked up in the 1980s, in part because of economic problems and a population explosion in Mexico, in part because of the legacy of these wars that hit much of Central America during that time. The fact that they're organized in these groups that are migrating together, I've seen different reporting kind of trying to conjecture why, some of it relying on conspiracy theories that, you know, international financiers or even Venezuela or the Venezuelan government is behind it. But I don't think that the core issue here has changed, which is that you have people in these countries who are seeking a better life.
Freddie wrote, my name is Freddie, and I'm a national of El Salvador. I grew up playing in my backyard just like any other kid. Often, I found used bullets with the name EU, as in Estados Unidos, or the United States, and Russia as well, back in the mid-80s. Cold War, perhaps? We also got some questions about another nation that some of our listeners are wondering about the involvement of. Professor Grandin, Mystic Warrior, tweeted, why don't we see migrants fleeing the socialist dictatorship in Nicaragua? And Ellen asked a similar question, why aren't people leaving Nicaragua? Isn't it just as poor? Professor Grandin, what about Nicaragua? How does that factor into this, or does it?
Well, it does, and that's a great comparison, and it's a great question. I think they are now. There's a political crisis that is driving some migration out, but up until fairly recently, Nicaragua was exempt. And one of the reasons why Nicaragua has been exempt is because of the Nicaraguan Revolution. And depending on one's point of view, that was the Sandinista Revolution in 1979, the first run of power up until 1990, established a fairly coherent state. Now, and what I mean by that is that gangs didn't flood the vacuum of power as they did in these criminal networks and cartels that Liz is talking about in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. The degree of corruption and breakdown of state power didn't take place. The other important factor in why Nicaragua has been fairly exempt has to do with the Cold War. You know, there's been a lot of talk about MS-13. MS-13 was a gang that was organized and established in Los Angeles prisons. And the reason why is because during the Cold War, migrants from Nicaragua fleeing the Sandinistas, the left-wing Sandinista government, were treated fairly well in the United States. Mm-hmm. They weren't turned into criminals. They weren't criminalized. Migrants fleeing U.S. allies in Guatemala, in Honduras, and in El Salvador were treated like criminals, and you treated like criminals, you became criminals. They were thrown into the penitentiary system, and that's where the networks that eventually evolved into these horrible gangs that are terrorizing their home countries in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. So here you see a direct blowback from Cold War policy. The same reason Cuba doesn't have gangs, because Cuban migrants that flee to the United States are treated fairly decently.
Let's pause right there for 1 second. We'll continue our conversation and look ahead to what might happen going forward in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Brian Winter, Professor Greg Grandin, and Professor Elizabeth Oglesby. Still time to get some of your questions answered about the situation at the border and how our history with Central America factors into all this. I know this is complex. There are lots and lots and lots of moving parts with this that are economic and have to do with fighting communism and corrupt governments and rebel groups and the drug trade. It's incredibly complicated. So if you're feeling a little lost, now is a good time to get your questions answered. No judgment for trying to break down these tough geopolitical issues, because they are tough to understand. So please share your questions with us, 1A@WAMU.org. Or maybe I'm just the one who's confused. But joining us now is one more person to help unconfuse me, who you may recognize from the Friday News Roundup from time to time, Franco Ordonez, a White House correspondent at McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Franco, welcome.
Great to be here.
Am I alone in feeling like this is wildly complex stuff to understand?
It is so complex. I spend hours speaking to your other guests, asking them, what does this mean? What is the impact? I talk to lawyers. What are the legal ramifications? I talk to administrations, asking them, why is this happening? What are you going to do about it? And you talk from one administration to another administration, you get a completely different answer. You talk from one agency to another agency. You talk to NSC, you talk to Department of State. Everyone's got a different philosophy of how to approach this problem. As you pointed out, it is so complicated. There's so many moving parts. It's hard to find the right answer.
Is that part, Franco, of why maybe policy for the U.S. policy towards Central America maybe hit or miss, maybe causes more problems than it solves problems? Is that part of it as well, just
absolutely,
because there are so many moving parts?
Absolutely. It's absolutely an issue there. You also obviously got the politics of it. I mean, Obama, you know, he faced this as well back in 2014. When we had that historic rise of unaccompanied children that were coming in. There was also obviously families that were coming in at this time. And he also sought to respond to public outcry to address this. He did some of the same things that Trump did, maybe with some of the less rhetoric. But, you know, he sent the National Guard down to the border. He erected tent cities. He did a lot of these things. But then in 2016, at the end of his administration, in his State of the Union address, he also acknowledged that this is not a quick fix issue, that we need to be, as he said, patient. We need a long-term solution. And we gotta stick with this if it's going to be solved.
We've heard from some of you about past policies from previous administrations. Stan writes, I worked in the State Department on Central American Affairs during the Reagan administration in the 80s. Reagan's Central American Initiative poured billions into the region but did not press economic and political reforms, while supporting the Contras took priority. A lot of wasted money was the result, and a great opportunity to achieve progress was missed. One person who does know Central America very, very well is John Kelly, who is the former White House Chief of Staff. He was also before that the Secretary of Homeland Security. And before that, he was the head of U.S. Southern Command, SOUTHCOM. That's the kind of unified military command based west of Miami that oversees military operations in Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. We interviewed him on 1A back in June of 2017 when he was still DHS Secretary regarding Central America. Here is part of what then Secretary Kelly told us.
You know, one of my first conversations with the president might have been when he was still the president-elect. I said, the Southwest border, there's numerous ways to secure, to gain control of the Southwest border. And one of those is to work with our great partners 1,000, 1,500 miles south of the Rio Grande. If we are trying to stop everything purely on the one-yard line, so to speak, a goal line stand day in, day out, we've lost.
That was former Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly speaking in June of 2017. Franco, that goal line stance that Secretary Kelly talked about feels a lot like the strategy at the border. Everything we discussed in that interview, I remember very vividly, he was very serious about partnering with Mexico and the Northern Triangle nations so that we could prevent people from even wanting to get to the one-yard line. How far has that strategy gone with this administration since then?
Huh. You know, I mean, like, they got all the defensive linemen right up at the line, and they're trying to block. Trump wants to obviously put more defensive linemen there, bigger defensive linemen, and probably pump them up with some more steroids so that they'll get even bigger. But as John Kelly has said, you know, there are, and your guests have said, there are so many structural issues going on that this is an issue that you just It is very, very hard to address this in a short-term solution. I was talking to a foreign minister of Guatemala yesterday about this, and he's like, look, his concerns with the Trump administration are just that they want a quick fix. They want an answer now, and you're just not going to get an answer now. There are so many complicated factors at pushing it. You guys have talked about the history, the Cold War, the violence, the economic. There's also the family reunification. Back in 2008, I was covering poultry plants and pork plants, and they're just thousands and thousands of Guatemalans and Salvadoran men who came over to work in those plants because, frankly, a lot of Americans don't necessarily want to do the work. Also, the pay is not that high, and it's just ugly work. 2014 and 2015, what he told me you are seeing then and now is the family reunification. It's the magnet of people coming here to be with their families, to be with their husbands, to be with their parents. Then obviously the economy of the United States is doing pretty good right now, and the economies of those countries are rough. You can't get as many jobs.
Now, does this evolve, Franco, over time, whereas, you know, we mentioned earlier with the border, it used to be basically kind of open. You could come into the U.S., do seasonal work, go back. As the border has gotten more secured and more militarized, the incentive to go back and forth lessens because it's just harder to cross the border. Does that make it even more appealing for someone over time, as the policy has changed, to come into the U.S., find work, say, in a poultry plant, put down roots, and then try to bring the rest of the family, which brings all the attendant problems with smuggling rings and so forth? It sounds like a problem that gets worse over time.
No, absolutely. I mean, appealing is one way to put it. Another way is like necessary for these families if you want to stay with your family. Many members of these communities have told me that they felt they had no choice. They would much rather just go back and forth. There are communities out, you know, rural communities that you guys were talking about in Guatemala, in Mexico, where you can see from, you know, back in the day, old U.S. Money helping build those infrastructures. Well, those men now can no longer go back because they don't have that ease of flexibility to go back. So they need to bring their families, if they want to be together, to the United States. And they're kind of stuck here because they can't go back and forth.
We're speaking to Franco Ordonez of McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Before I go back to the panel, Franco, what you said that you were speaking to a Guatemalan foreign minister just yesterday. What are the countries in Central America saying about what they would like to see happen? Are they and the Trump administration seeing eye to eye on where we go from here, or are there things that they are requesting or requesting less of that just aren't being heard?
I mean, it's definitely a mix of things. You know, I was with the foreign minister that I was talking to, and it was a very recent former foreign minister. I don't want to say that it was today's foreign minister, but he certainly was wanting more sustainable, more assistance in USAID money, more federal aid.
The U.S. Agency for International Development.
Absolutely. And more kind of economic support to provide more sustainability. A lot of times they will point to what Plan Colombia, which was the $10 billion that the United States funded over a decade to help Colombia come out of some of these kind of similar problems that had to do with violence and drugs, you know, stabilize the courts, stabilize law enforcement, kind of build the economy so that so that people would not need to come to the United States. A lot of people think that that is what is necessary, but there's not necessarily the will, and you need a lot of will to do something like that.
Speaking of economy, that gets to a few more comments that came in from our audience, and I'll bring the panel back in after I read a few of these. Angie tweeted, "I am a Honduran who migrated to the USA when I was 8 years old. This was back in 1999, and the reasons are still the same. The lack of employment, the level of crime. For decades, the USA has intervened in Central American policy to the interest of the US and US-based companies that come and use the land and resources and later leave. I travel often to visit family and can clearly see that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. There is no middle class." Richard tweeted, "Since those three countries' regimes depend on remittances from expatriates, could it be that by not enforcing our immigration laws, we end up supporting those corrupt governments and in a way sustaining the misery of their population?" Professor Oglesby, that's an interesting question. What do you think of Richard's question?
I think that what's going on right now this week in Guatemala is a very deep crisis in which it's a constitutional crisis, and no solution is possible in Guatemala unless there is progress in addressing the underlying issue of impunity, in removing the criminal networks that control the Guatemalan state. So I think that any talk about a large-scale economic aid program like a Plan Marshall is useless at this point unless there is a deeper reform in the Guatemalan state. Now, it's not hopeless. Guatemalans have been struggling really hard to build a viable judiciary, to build the rule of law, to prosecute corruption, to prosecute organized crime. They've got the support of the United Nations through the International Commission Against Impunity, which works in Guatemala, CICIG. Up until this year, the United States has been very supportive of that commission, the Anti-Impunity Commission, CICIG. But in the last year, the Trump administration has turned its back on CICIG as Guatemalan President Jimmy Morales has gone after the commission and finally just this week expelled the commission, unilaterally terminated its mandate illegally, I might add, because this is a treaty between the Guatemalan Congress and the United Nations.
So, Professor Oglesby, I hate to cut you short. I know our time is limited. I just want to make sure that we hit Richard's question right on the head. It sounds like what he's also asking about with regard to these corrupt governments, and I hear where you're getting at in terms of government transparency, it sounds like kind of what he's asking is that by not enforcing our immigration laws, people from these countries make it into the U.S., earn revenue, send money back, and they're sending money back to corrupt governments. So maybe enforcing our laws at the border can help stem the flow of money that keeps these corrupt governments in power.
Actually, the militarization of the border that's happened since the 1990s has generated an increase in migration. The family reunification issue is one issue, not being able to go back and forth. The increased cost of the passage, it now costs $10,000 or $12,000, and these routes are controlled by criminal networks in Mexico. So what that means is that people go into debt to be able to get to the border.
Right.
If they're deported. So if we are so increased border enforcement means increased deportation of people who have gone into debt and sold their lands in order to make that journey. People have no choice but to return to the United States. So what people in the U.S. have to understand is that the militarization of the border that's gone on since the 1990s generates more migration.
Gotcha. Let me get to Brian Winter and Professor Grandin. I know our time is short, but give me a sense, Professor Grandin, just briefly, of one policy shift that you would suggest that the U.S. consider in order to deal with the underlying issues in the Northern Triangle. What's one thing that you would like to see the government at least consider?
Well, if we were to have an aid program, because I know oftentimes aid programs are thrown out as a solution, that we have to solve the problem at the source, we have to create a sustainable society. They have to be economic policies that are actually people-centric and community-centric, that rebuild local markets, that rebuild regional economies, right? When oftentimes, and this was true under Bush, it was true under Obama, it'll be true under Trump, is what passes as development aid is really just building the infrastructure of dispossession and dislocation that drives the migration forward. So we have to get out of this idea that the United States needs to do more in general terms, that it has to actually rethink its whole economic policy. I mean, think about NAFTA, just a step back. The North American Free Trade Agreement displaced 5 million Mexican families because they couldn't compete with cheap U.S. corn. And that's the reason why the militarization of the border and the implementation of NAFTA went hand in hand. They knew, the people who put NAFTA into place knew that this migration was going to be driven forward. In terms of remittances, remittances don't uphold corrupt governments. They support desperate, starving families. And in some ways, they slow down deforestation. There's been studies that remittances actually are one of the only things that helps sustain whatever ecology is still viable in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala. What upholds these corrupt governments are the security policies of the United States, right? And these aren't just any random countries. Central America has been in the orbit and sphere of influence of the most powerful country in world history for over a century. Mm-hmm. It is structured and built and organized. The United States isn't the only, I'm not saying Central Latin United States is the only source of these countries' problems.
Right.
But the ruling class would not be ruling if it was not for the United States.
Let me give Brian Winter one more chance to jump in before our time is up. Brian, one thing policy-wise you'd like to see the U.S. consider before we got to go?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not always about us. And building on what the professor said, I think that there are reforms that could be enacted in these countries, which include getting more people to pay their fair share in taxes. And these are governments that just don't collect enough taxes to be able to provide education, infrastructure. We had the Attorney General of Guatemala come to the Council of the Americas last year and tell us that just 1 in 10 of these towns in Guatemala have a prosecutor. That's a government that just doesn't have enough resources, and that's partly a problem of the economic elites just not paying enough. And then other reforms that can make the economy grow, can generate employment, can help generate conditions for infrastructure, reduce corruption. Those are the things, and I, in no way denigrating, the U.S. has played a negative role over the years, to be sure. Mm-hmm. But in my time in Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, if you talk to people about what they feel stands in their way of prosperity in modern times, it's their own government. It's not ours.
Brian Winter, editor-in-chief for America's Quarterly, Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent for McClatchy, Professor Elizabeth Oglesby of Arizona State University, and NYU Professor Greg Grandin. Everyone, thanks very much for being with us. This conversation was produced by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of our team, visit theoneA.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.